This is Thursday, the 10th day of November, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming your way, Donald Trump is paying a visit to the White House. We'll talk about it with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Also ahead, many are comparing the election success of Donald Trump to the British Brexit vote. Why?
If I'm working in a factory and my factory closes down because of greater international trade, I'm out of a job and I'm not happy about it. And I may not like the appeal, well, it's good for the rest of us or it's good for the whole world. You know, I just care that I lost my job.
And where will the new U.S. administration go as far as its relationship with South Korea? We'll talk with VOA's Steve Miller. All on today's International Edition. Donald Trump is now in the midst of his first visit to the White House as president-elect, with President Barack Obama ordering government agencies to ease the path for him to take control when he assumes power on January 20th. First Lady Michelle Obama is meeting privately with Trump's wife Melania about life in the private quarters of the executive mansion. The White House said that long before the Republican Trump stunning upset Tuesday over Hillary Clinton became apparent, Clinton directed officials last year to make a smooth transition between administrations a top priority of his last year in office.
So I have instructed my team to follow the example that President Bush's team set 8 years ago and work as hard as we can to make sure that this is a successful transition for the president-elect. Because we are now all rooting for his success in uniting and leading the country.
VOA national correspondent Jim Malone joins us now. Jim, considering the very harsh words the president and president-elect made during the campaign, can this really be a cordial meeting? Is that a possibility?
Of course it's possible. I think both Secretary Clinton and President Obama in their public remarks on Wednesday tried to focus on reconciliation, on moving ahead. The president said he has a job to do, which is to oversee this transition in an orderly way. That's the democratic tradition in this country. Now, keep in mind that both have been very personal about each other on the campaign trail. Don't forget who is behind the birther questions.
Yep.
It was Donald Trump. And on the other side, President Obama was pretty dismissive of Trump on the campaign trail on behalf of Hillary Clinton right up to the end of the campaign. So there's no love lost there, but we've got a situation where it's about the country now.
President Obama, yesterday, when he made his comments about a transition, gave credit to George W. Bush as far as a transition is concerned. Explain what that was all about.
Right. I mean, it's just the procedure in our democracy where over the next few months, one administration gets ready to hand over to another. You mentioned George W. Bush. It was a little more tense in 2001. When Bush had narrowly defeated Gore in an election in which the Supreme Court interceded. And I think, if I remember at the time, there were reports that some White House staffers had taken the W out of some of the keyboards at the White House.
Yes, I remember.
So there were some bad feelings back then, but, you know, they got past it. Are the bad feelings potentially worse this time? There are some hard feelings out there, and it's not just at the White House. It's not just inside the Beltway where we are in Washington. All across the country, I mean, the divide in the United States was more apparent than ever on election night. And the folks that had hoped the election would kind of meld that divide, unfortunately, we're all going to be disappointed. The divide will go on.
We are awaiting an end to that conversation. We really don't know if Trump and or President Bush will come out of the White House and talk to the press about what has happened, or whether we might get one of those videotape delayed things though, with meetings on the White House. But while in Washington, Trump also has set up meetings with the House of Representatives Speaker Paul Ryan, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, leaders of the Republican majorities in each chamber about their legislative plans. Now, both, as you know, gave some tepid support to Trump during the election, but vowed to work in concert with him to pass the party's agenda. How do you think that's going to go?
Well, welcome to the political equivalent of, you know, three-dimensional chess. We've got a president-elect who basically was dismissive of Clinton and Obama together and their whole legacy, but also was very dismissive of the Republican establishment, as represented by people like Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader. Well, he's going to have to work with them now. And Trump was strong on principles during the campaign, I would say, but light on details. The congressional leaders are much more known to fill in the blanks on details, particularly Paul Ryan. So the question now is, how does Trump and Ryan and McConnell come together to agree, say, on how they want to do away with Obamacare, what replaces it, how they want to undo the nuclear treaty with Iran? I mean, once you get now into the details of this, and what do you focus on the first 100 days? Because that's when the new president most likely will have the most political capital to spend.
And also where Trump has made many of his promises in the first few days.
And the promises were primarily to the constituency that elected him, white working class workers who rose up across the country, especially in battleground states where Democrats have reigned for years in presidential elections. But he owes them first and foremost on the economy and on immigration, the foundation of his candidacy.
Andrew Palshevsky, our social media guru, joins us again. What's social media saying up to the second as you're watching it?
Well, we're seeing...
He's sitting here with his smartphone. He always is. In fact, I think it's attached to his hand.
It's the way I stay current. It keeps a pulse on what people are saying. What I'm seeing in social media is kind of a microcosm of what's happening in the U.S. These two competing interests are kind of playing out. There's a group of people who are saying, let's come together, let's reconcile, let's move forward as a country. But then there's a group of people who are very angry about this result, who are vowing to fight, to protest, and to continue to stay angry. So we see hashtag Trump protests. There were a number of protests throughout the United States last night in major cities where people were marching and holding signs. Some of those protests happening at Trump Tower in New York. And so we're seeing that kind of galvanize people on social media. We're seeing people talking about the Electoral College. The way it's shaping up right now, it looks like Hillary Clinton could win the popular vote but lose the Electoral College. So there's a petition that's circulating online for people to encourage electors not to vote for Donald Trump and vote for Hillary Clinton when they meet on December 19th.
Jim, can you explain why the Electoral College is the way it is? Do we know that?
In terms of the procedure?
Yeah.
And why
we even have it?
Why is it the whole basis of it? Well, to the founding of the Republic, there was some distrust of popular vote. So they put in this stipulation that electors from the states would be the ones who would actually choose who the president would be. Over time, this has evolved into a system where primarily the electors in the various states confirm how that state voted in popular vote. So it reflects that. But we have a case where Hillary Clinton leads the popular vote right now by more than 200,000. It would be, I believe, the fifth time in history where the person who got the most popular votes did not become president. It's a quirk of the system if you want to look at it that way, but they decided they wanted to come up with a system of state-by-state electoral votes that would get you the presidency.
Jim Malone, Andrew Palshevsky, thank you both for your input, as always, here on International Edition. Among the top stories today, Donald Trump is making his first visit to the White House as president-elect, with President Obama ordering government agencies to ease the path for him to take control when he assumes power. The U.S. military says its airstrike campaign targeting Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria killed 64 civilians during the past year. Rights groups and monitors say the real number is much higher than that. United Nations warns that besieged eastern Aleppo in northern Syria faces mass starvation this winter. And a Chinese senior public security official is the new head of the International Criminal Police Organization. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on VOA's mobile apps. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have spotted super hot blobs of plasma blasting into space like cannonballs near a dying red giant star some 1,200 light years away. The scientists found that the balls of hot gas fly so fast that if astronauts went at their speed, a trip from the Earth to the Moon would only take 30 minutes. It's estimated that one of these cosmic artillery blasts has taken place every 8.5 years for at least the past 400 years. Hubble Space Telescope data revealed a sequence of these giant gas balls that date back to 1986. The plasma ball's temperature is thought to be more than 9,500 degrees Celsius, which is about twice as hot as the surface of the sun. Scientists think that the plasma balls are being ejected by a nearby and unseen companion to the dying star. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Today on International Edition, we'll talk about similarities being drawn between Donald Trump's victory in Tuesday's U.S. presidential election and Britain's vote on Brexit, the decision by the British people to disassociate itself from the EU. Before the election, Trump himself compared his run for president to the British decision.
At the ballot box on November 8th, we are going to do something so special. It'll be called Brexit plus plus plus.
We welcome to International Edition James Hartley, a professor of economics at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. Professor, thanks for being with us. What similarities can you explain between the Trump win and the Brexit vote?
I think what both of these elections show is that both Britain and America are deeply divided. On the one side, in both countries, there's a set of what we can think of as the intellectual elites. They went to elite colleges, they work in education and media and government, and they have this very common worldview across the countries. They tend to talk of themselves as being global citizens or part of a global community. And on the other side, in both countries, we have what we can think of as the other America or the other Britain. And these are people whose primary loyalties are to family or community or, most importantly, nation. And I think what we saw in both elections, and you can see it in the campaign slogans, is a big clash between these two groups of people. The Trump campaign slogan of Make America Great Again. And so one set of Americans hear that and they say, yes, we want America to be great again. And on the other side, you had people saying, well, when was America ever great? Or why should America be great? And in Britain, we saw the slogan for the Brexit was, we want our country back. And this is an assertion that people want to be British and not European. And on the other side, people sneering and saying, well, why wouldn't you want to be a part of Europe? And I think what we have is this sort of intellectual elite just fundamentally do not understand the other sets of people out there. They look down on them. They tend to want to call them racists or fascists. And what we saw in the election is this whole set of people are just tired of that. They're just tired of being called fascists and racists. And they want their nation, and they're voting for vaguely nationalist appeals in both countries. And it's just sort of a revolt of just people saying, I want to be an American, I don't want to be part of a global community. I want to be British, I don't want to be part of a global community.
Economically speaking, is this dangerous to the countries that are entering this realm?
I don't know if it's dangerous or not. It's just it's a different way of thinking about international economic relations. You saw it in both of them with things like international trade. International trade is a complicated issue. The economics of it are straightforward. As you do more and more international trade, it benefits both countries. It's unambiguous in the literature. But that's different than it benefits every single individual person. If I'm working in a factory and my factory closes down because of greater international trade, I'm out of a job and I'm not happy about it. And I may not like the appeal, well, it's good for the rest of us or it's good for the whole world. You know, I just care that I lost my job. And I think, again, we have a whole set of people running countries that just haven't spent enough time learning how to talk to and listen to people that really did lose their jobs as these things happen. So the danger is we sort of, you know, throw out the baby with the bathwater. You know, you sort of just, you lose all the ability of having international trade because we've been unable to articulate or talk about this with people who are affected adversely by it.
Well, you just referenced the fact that this is not limited to Great Britain and the United States. More and more is coming up, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think this sort of divide is going to be fairly common throughout the world as this sort of set of people, this intellectual elite, really are transnational. They're in all the different countries. They meet. They have this common worldview. And what we can imagine is sort of increasing amounts of people in country after country, you know, reasserting their nationhood. How it'll work out in elections going forward is hard to tell because we don't know the relative percentages in all these countries. Part of the problem we have in all the polling data is for the people that you know, want to assert the primacy of nation, you know, if you say, I want to be American or I want to be British, people are going to call you a fascist, you might be reluctant to articulate that you really do care about your nation. And so the polling data on this gets really rough when we can't rely on people honestly revealing what they vote.
What kind of economic changes do you see a Trump presidency precipitating?
You know, I think it's completely open book there. We don't really know what Donald Trump is going to do as president. He ran for presidency, you know, largely on sort of vague platitudes and sort of, you know, very emotional appeals. What his governing philosophies will be, what policies out of all the many things he talked about in the campaign he's going to implement, we really have no way of knowing. I'm not sure Donald Trump really knows yet, too. I mean, a lot of it will be, we'll find out when he starts filling in his cabinet, by what type of people does he bring into the cabinet to know out of all the things he talked about, which ones are really his priorities.
Professor James Hartley is chair of economics at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. Thanks so much, Professor.
My pleasure.
Joining us on the phone from Beijing is Bureau Chief Bill Ide. Trump has been very strong as far as U.S.-China trade policies being very hard on China. Do you see that as one point of contention, and what might be some others?
There's a lot of uncertainty there. Actually, on CCTV today, there were some Chinese commentators. They were talking about how there's always uncertainty in the transition period between new presidents in the United States, because it's a new person coming in and you got to get to know this new person. Everybody has a different approach to things, but they note that Donald Trump is a lot more uncertainty there, and he's not really like he's not your average Republican. There's a lot of things that he said on the campaign trail, pledging to implement import tariffs of 45% on his first day in the office to declare China a currency manipulator. He has time and time again advocated a very tough approach when it comes to China, using measures and tools in a different way, I guess, to renegotiate what he says, renegotiate the relationship, this trade relationship with China. And it's not only the trade relationship with China, but it's other trade relationships across the world as well that he has taken issue with, NAFTA included. And so there's definitely a lot of uncertainty about how he may approach things, and that's going to create tensions. There was a professor that I spoke with earlier today, and a Chinese professor and a political scientist, who said that really, there's going to be a lot of economic hardship, he feels, that with Trump's election, things are going to get worse. They're going to get worse for the world, and they're going to get worse for China. And the financial situation is going to get a lot tougher, which is really, really a big issue for the Chinese government, the Communist Party, because their whole the whole base of their leadership and the reason why people would allow them to rule as a single party is based on the economic wealth that they provide to the public. But that is changing now. The economy is slowing down, and some see Trump's election, and the policies that he, at least on the campaign trail, he's advocated as having an impact on the economy, not only in the world, but China as well.
Bill Ide is the Beijing Bureau Chief for VOA, the Voice of America. Bill, thanks so much as always. This is VOA.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
This is the Voice of America, International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. President-elect Trump has tried to reassure allies in Northeast Asia that are apprehensive over the possibility he may actually follow through on the radical policy changes he suggested during the campaign. During that campaign, Trump voiced some sharp criticism of South Korea and Japan for not bearing enough of the financial burden for American forces stationed in their countries.
I keep asking, how long will we go on defending South Korea from North Korea without payment? South Korea is a very, very rich country. They're rich because of us. They sell us televisions. They sell us cars. They sell us everything. They are making a fortune. We have a huge deficit with South Korea. They're friends of mine. I do deals with them. I've been partners with them. No problem. But they think we're stupid. They can't believe it. We are defending them against North Korea. We're doing it for nothing. We're not in that position. When will they start to pay us for this defense? Isn't it really ridiculous when you think of it? They make a fortune in the United States, and they've got some problems. And what happens? They call the United States to defend them, and we get nothing?
VOA Steve Miller has spent a good part of his life living and working in South Korea. He joins us in the studio. Steve, what's been Seoul's reaction so far to Trump's comments?
Well, there's been a lot of comments made over his entire candidacy, and going back to this clip that was played, going during the campaign itself when he made this statement that South Korea doesn't pay its fair share. South Korea does pay about $866 million annually to the United States for the armed forces there.
But they're so rich, right?
But they're so rich. Yeah. What happened recently as the Trump campaign became more certain that it would become President-elect Trump, the papers in South Korea then started to focus more on what this does mean for them as a nation. Headlines across the nation focused on what does this mean. Students in classes were telling their English teachers, asking them what is going to happen. President-elect Trump did speak with President Park Geun-hye in Seoul, and according to South Korean media, they had a very cordial and warm conversation where President-elect Trump is said to have agreed and will maintain and honor existing defense agreements with South Korea.
Now, what about North Korea? What about the president-elect's comments and stance as far as the North is concerned, Pyongyang?
Well, we have seen reports in recent months that perhaps North Korea will conduct another Musudan, a medium-range missile test in the near future, perhaps a sixth nuclear test as well. President-elect Trump is seen as someone who is much more aggressive as far as his foreign policy on what to do with North Korea. But it remains unseen what that will manifest in the regional tension.
But North Korea has come out with a positive response to this election, has it not?
It has. It has said that electing Trump is a wise choice. They're hoping that this will also open up direct conversations with them.
Steve Miller. And Steve, plug your podcast, will you?
It's called Asia Weekly. You can find it on voanews.com.
That's Steve Miller. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our thanks to Director Patrice Martin, our engineer Nick Ivanoff. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
20 years after the United States and Vietnam normalized their relations, the two countries have steadily strengthened their cooperation. The bilateral relationship has never been stronger, cooperating on a full spectrum of issues, including education, science and technology, climate change, sustainability, public health, and security. Indeed, in May of this year, during a visit to Vietnam, President Barack Obama announced the lifting of the decades-old arms embargo. By doing so, President Obama removed the lingering vestiges of the Cold War and ensures that Vietnam has access to the equipment it needs to defend itself. This change also underscored the commitment of the United States to a fully normalized relationship with Vietnam, including strong defense ties with Vietnam and the region for the long term. Building upon the May 2016 visit of President Obama to Vietnam and the July 2015 visit of the Communist Party of Vietnam's General Secretary Nguyen Phu Chau to the United States, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry invited Dinh Thu Vinh, Executive Secretary of the Communist Party of Vietnam's Central Committee, to Washington to deepen engagement between the two governments. Secretary Kerry and Mr. Nguyen reiterated the two countries' commitment to deepening our comprehensive partnership, promoting trade and economic growth, and strengthening regional security and stability. Additionally, they discussed the peaceful management and resolution of disputes in the South China Sea, cooperating on humanitarian and disaster relief response, advancing human rights and legal reform, and collaborating on climate change mitigation and adaptation, particularly in the Mekong Delta. Both underscored their country's commitment to ratify the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a free trade agreement that has the potential to shape the future of the region. "We both share a commitment to the peaceful use and respect for rule of law in the South China Sea," said Secretary of State Kerry during a joint press conference. "The people of Vietnam today are witnessing a remarkable economic revolution. They are engaged in an amazing economic endeavor, a capitalist endeavor. It's one of the fastest growing countries in the region. We very much look forward to a very productive relationship.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.